Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at richarddugan.com. We are also podcasting at richarddugan.com. Not only the radio shows page, but actually when you go to richarddugan.com, boom, you're going to see a listing of all of the interviews we've done for 2018. Then you can also go to our radio shows page for programs going back to 2017 and before, the previous 10 years of programs. So we encourage you to do that as well. I think that you will find them interesting. I hope that you will anyway. I hope you'll find them edifying and inspiring as well, and encourage you to do more research by going to the links to those programmers, to those guests that we've had on the program to find out more. We are also on SoundCloud and iTunes, so we encourage you as well. We're on Facebook as well as Twitter, so we're trying to cover the gamut. Being that this is a radio show, it's kind of hard to do some of these other picture social media kinds of things, but maybe one of these days we'll branch out. We are going to have an interesting conversation today. I'm really very excited about this program. We're going to talk about some very interesting subjects with a gentleman who has written a book. The latest work is The Story of Our Time. And Robert Atkinson is my guest. I want to thank him. Thank you, Robert, for joining us here on the program. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, Richard. Great to be with you.
The Story of Our Time. Now, are we going back hundreds, thousands, billions of years? Or is this, say, in the last 50 years?
That's a great question to start off with. I'm using our time as in terms of how we understand the evolution of religion and in terms of spiritual epics that happened throughout history. And so our time refers to the most recent spiritual epic that we're in currently. And that takes in about the last century and three quarters, actually. So from the mid-1800s to today, and as we all can imagine, incredible changes have taken place since the mid-1800s to today.
And one of those changes, most notably, at least from my perspective, has been the, and I say this in a positive way, the dilution of philosophies one to another. Because before then, for the most part, they were all separate. You had your little clusters in different parts of the world, and that's where you focused all of your attention, I suppose. I'm not even going to try to name the parts of the world and the philosophies that they adhered to, but there wasn't a lot of cross-pollination, shall we say?
Right. That's very true with the time that we're talking about in this period, because prior to the mid-1800s, there was very little communication across countries or across regions, and now it's totally the opposite. We can communicate across the globe in seconds, nanoseconds. And so it's been a process of bringing the world together into a global community is really what's been happening.
Now,
go ahead. And as you say, that process of bringing the world together in the way it has resulted in exactly what you were describing, the intermingling and merging of philosophies and worldviews. And so there's been an incredible amount of evolutionary progress in terms of our consciousness of the world that we're living in during that time.
And at the same time, not that we'll spend a lot of time on this particular aspect, but at the same time, there has also been just as much angst over the cross-pollination, if you will, of these different religions, as far as the, shall we say, the traditionalists or fundamentalists of those philosophies, basically saying ours is the only way and yours is wrong and you must convert or we'll kill you. Of course, that's going on to this day.
Right, and that's another really important part of that same process, both happening at the same time, because what it's about is the breakdown of an old way of seeing things and the building up of a new way of seeing things. And so there's going to be those that are resisting that shift, that change to a more integrative perspective, and they're going to be, and they'll want to hold on to their longstanding views that have kind of outlived their usefulness. And there's that reluctance to let go of the old while the new is being brought in place.
And of course, that's one of the things that we talk about on this program, is looking for those new ways of living, because the old ways just don't work anymore. And all you have to do is look around you and you can see that they aren't working, because we have such an inequity across the globe. The class system is very much alive around the world. There was a politician here in California running an ad. Guy was running for governor, and I'm not even going to mention his name because I neither endorse nor criticize specific individuals. But this particular candidate was talking about how he wanted to focus on education, which I'm all for. I want people to get an education so that they can know of and even create new choices for their lives and their path. But the end of that statement was so that they can make it to, and this is what bothered me, make it to the middle class. And I thought, wait, that's as far as you want them to go? Why would you target them to a particular class? Why not say so they could go as far as they want to go? I thought, wait a minute. And of course, when you talk about these different philosophies around the world over the last 150, 200 plus years of this particular work we're talking about, even those philosophies were of the same mindset, that we have to keep women in a particular, and again, this is depending upon which philosophy you choose to adhere to, we have to keep women in a particular box. We have to keep men in a particular box, depending upon their race and their station in life, or the peasant or the slave or whatever it is, on and on. I mean, just constantly compartmentalizing people to keep them where the powers that be want them. That seems, and to me, the detriment to that attitude, if you will, that extreme attitude, has been the cross-pollination, because people are beginning to realize, wait a minute, there are some other philosophies that are a lot more liberating or liberated than mine. I kind of like that. I want to explore that. And if they're willing to take the risk, and a lot of times take their lives into their own hands, then they go off into that direction. That's happening more and more today, isn't it? Where you get these polls here in America talking about X number of people are professing Christians. But then there's an even larger segment that says, well, I'm not religious because I don't go to church, but I do consider myself spiritual.
Yeah, that's all part of the process that's happening, that's unfolding in our time. And it's really about our time is one of the primary characteristics of our time is about the quest for consciousness. And when we look at consciousness, it's really about fulfilling our potential, our inherent innate potential. And who knows, as you said, who knows where that could lead anyone when they actually have the opportunity and the means and the support and everything to fulfill their own quest for consciousness and fulfill that urge to understand reality. There is no limit to where that could take anyone from wherever they start. So it's a process that has an unknown ending and one that is about fulfilling our innate potential, whatever that is, for each individual.
Yeah, and it just is very interesting to me. And of course, we kind of see that today within our political system. There are going to be the diehards who aren't going to give up their party for love or money. But there are a lot more people, from what I'm observing, who are basically saying, you know, I don't like the way this thing is going. And this is on both. This is on all the sides, all the different political perspectives. And they're saying, I don't like this. It's not what I signed up for. I can't even talk to people about from a salient point of view about a topic, because the next thing I know, I could get verbally or physically assaulted because of my views. And obviously, that's been happening on a religious level as well. Do you see that this is sort of a spillover from the philosophical or religious cross-pollination, if you will, that there are those who that isn't a question of feeling disenfranchised. They don't want to be franchised. They don't want to be a part of this mess. I mean, I'm kind of one of those who says, "No, if this is the way you're going to play this game, I want no part."
Well, that's all part of the process that's unfolding as well. And what we're seeing happening all around, as you describe, is a clash of opposing views and opposing forces. And that's, that can get kind of uncomfortable and difficult at times, but it really is, all of that really is a necessary part of the process that leads ultimately to transformation. And we're not going to get to the personal or global transformation that is underway already and inevitable to be completed at some point or another in some way or another until we allow those opposing forces to come in contact with each other and experience the clash of views that there are, because that's the only way that that the merging of opposing forces will come about, which will then lead to the transformation process completing itself. So it's all about recognizing those opposing forces as catalysts to transformation, and letting that. And partly, I mean, you know, if your consciousness is at a place where you can see that big picture perspective of it all, you know where that's going to lead ultimately. Even though in a moment there is that seemingly impossible to resolve clash of opposing forces and views, that's the only way that it is going to happen, the only way things will get resolved. And so, we have to see that whole process differently, seeing the opposing forces as a catalyst for the transformation that we all want in the world right now.
Well, let's talk about this process and where you see it taking us at the next tick of the clock beyond this moment or this time frame that you have elucidated in your book.
Well, it's it's difficult, if not impossible, to put a time frame on the process that is unfolding right now in the world, because it depends on so many factors, including each one of us individually, to form a collective whole that will bring about the process that will either speed up or slow down the process itself. So it's really, I can't really talk about a particular time frame, but I can talk about where the process is leading, and this is what we're in the midst of now is not new to the history of humanity by any means. We've gone through the same process of transformation during every spiritual epoch and every rise and fall of every civilization that we've known on this earth. And so the next, what we do know is what the process as a whole looks like. And so we can break that down into its steps or stages. And we can, one way to think of it is in the realm of traditional rites of passage, or if you're familiar with the ritual process, which begins with birth followed by death, a symbolic death, which then leads to a rebirth or a renewal. So the process can be broken down into those three steps, and there's so many variations on those three steps, from birth, death, rebirth, to separation, initiation, return, transition. another form that I like to use in the book is beginning, muddle, and resolution. So we're in the midst of a giant collective muddle right now, but what we do know about that muddle is that it's going to eventually lead to a resolution. How that resolution happens and when it happens is unknown, but it's up to us to make it happen. I mean, I think most people would want that process to happen smoothly and gently rather than catastrophically. But those are the options of the way that the process will complete itself. If things don't happen the way they could in terms of the world and everybody in it recognizing that this is a process that is designed to lead to transformation, renewal, rebirth, and the next step in our evolutionary process, then some people may be not only satisfied with, but may want the quicker, more catastrophic way to have things happen. And that's going to mean devastation and a lot of worse things for a lot of people. So that's really a choice that we have individually and collectively, how we're going to make this happen, how this process is going to come to its natural conclusion. And knowing that every muddle has its resolution, I think helps to not only understand the process itself, but bring about the end result that we all would hope for. So the gentle way, that is one of the kind of two options, involves recognizing certain universal, timeless, spiritual principles that have been around forever, but are still even more important today in the situation that we're in today. One of those timeless universal principles might be thinking of the golden rule or love as spiritual activism of our time rather than war. So that it's all a perspective and which of those values or spiritual values that we choose to live by, or on the other hand, if some people may choose to carry out things on a more practical, pragmatic level, which may negate the spiritual principles like love and justice and equality. So that's a big part of the choice of whether we go the gentle route or the catastrophic route is the whether we choose to live by the spiritual principles that have been around with us forever or some other way that can make it a lot more difficult.
Now, I've only been around for 58 years, a scant, less than a puff of smoke in time, even in reference to the years that you're talking about, 150, 200 years or so. My father is in his late 80s, he's got a little more time on me. And honestly, I'm already tired of the story, of the narrative that we have been fed, whether it has been philosophically. When I worked over at a Christian radio station, I was there for 15 years, and I kept hearing the same story over and over again, and I kept reading about how this story has been repeated over and over again over the last 2,000 years about the process by which we will be delivered from the devil, and there'll be the Battle of Armageddon, and then we'll have 1,000 years of peace, and so on and so on and so on. And I was already bored with that story. And I said, is there any way that I could help to make this a reality now so we could move forward into some new story? I'm just so tired of this. And you talk about, this is sort of in your subtitle, I love this, about, and again, it's the folks, this is called The Story of Our Time. Subtitle is From Duality to Interconnectedness to Oneness. And there's, you know, you talk about the two options. You know, we can either find this through peaceful means or catastrophe. And then there are those who say, well, we may not have any say in it. Mother Nature may do it for us. You can take a look right now at what's going on in Hawaii with the volcano, and of course, I'm down in Mexico, and they're now talking about what's going on up in Yellowstone and other parts of the world, and so forth and so on. And then there's the other paradox for me is, you and I would both agree that the ancient wisdom teachings all teach in some fashion about how we came from the One. You talk about in your subtitle to oneness, and they tell us that that's where we're going. But for some silly reason, beyond my mental comprehension, we're here dealing with duality. And it's like, you know, I pulled over to get some gas for my car, but I didn't figure on this. So talk to us a little bit about what we can do, not necessarily to perpetuate moving on evolutionarily to the next step, because I think we're going to do that, you know, whether we actively participate or just sit back on the sidelines and watch. But what about that my perceived dichotomy of this whole thing of we came from the One, we're living in a dualistic world now, and we're going back to the One, where neither of the two, past and future, have duality. They just are.
Well, so that's a really interesting kind of dilemma, play with. We can, and I think we should look at it from an evolutionary perspective. When the universe came into being, it was created from and with a consciousness of oneness, and everything evolved: plants and animals, and then human beings came along eventually. And as human beings began to populate the planet and move around and bump into each other in different places and create that created conflict, which then created and shifted our consciousness to a consciousness of duality. And we've lived with that consciousness of duality for centuries or millennia, really. And we're coming to a realization now that in order to survive on this planet, we can only do that if we live with a consciousness of oneness. So it's about that shift from a consciousness of duality to a consciousness of oneness. And that's been going on it has been a process that's been underway for millennia. And as I mentioned before, there have been pockets of resistance all the way along the whole process. Every era, every epoch has experienced that resistance. But the thing that's different about this whole process right now is that the only way we as a species and maybe as a planet are going to survive. If we continue to live in and with a consciousness of duality, we're going to those opposing forces are going to get so great and so disparate that they're going to create another global catastrophe beyond what we knew in World War I, World War II, that has the potential of destroying everything. And most people really don't want to see that kind of thing again. And it's a matter of every individual living, not just thinking that I really do have a consciousness of oneness, but it's beyond thinking about that. It's about living every moment of our lives with that consciousness and bringing it into action, carrying it out in action in our lives in every moment with every person that we meet. And this becomes especially important when we find ourselves interacting with someone who is in any way different than ourselves. And that And when there is that difference that becomes apparent in interacting with another person, that's when it becomes so crucial to retain that consciousness of oneness, and then carry that out by interacting in with that consciousness of oneness. I have what I call the oneness pledge on my website, which is kind of a simple thing, but this is really what I'm getting, the point that I'm getting to. And the oneness pledge is, in all my thoughts and actions, I pledge to look upon all things with the eye of oneness. And that, so that can become like a mantra for us. And if we really think about that, keep that in our mind and in our consciousness as we interact with each person we come in contact with, especially when they are different in some way than us. With that, and if we look at them and all people with the eye of oneness, that's what we'll see, and that's the way we'll respond and react and carry out. And that, so that needs to happen on an individual level, and it's got to, needs to spread from individual to individual till it eventually becomes something that happens on a collective level across the globe. And that's one of the some form of that type of interaction is the only thing that may save us from the devastation that can occur if we continue to exist with a consciousness of duality. And because what the consciousness of duality does is it forces us to see and to interact according to the opposing forces that are there at the in the moment. And so we can easily turn that around in our mind and in our actions by maintaining that that consciousness of oneness and looking upon all things with an eye of oneness and carrying it out. So it's all about action in the world today for us. And it's about seeing love as the spiritual activism of our time rather than anything else. I mean, when you talk about, or when you think about what has been happening in the, just within the last year or two, especially with things like the Women's March, which happened the year before last and then again this year, the Women's March was an example of how all of the human rights of the last couple of centuries kind of came together in that one day, in that group of people around the world that came together in that on that at that time and saw all of those human rights as one issue, not as separate issues, but as one issue. And that's the way that we will get to consciousness of oneness is by seeing all the individual human rights causes and issues as one larger. I mean, and so I go back to one of my mentors in my young adult years. I was in my mid-20s. I was happened to be in the right place in the right time to be able to be invited by Pete Seeger to sail on the maiden voyage of the Clearwater up the Hudson River in 1969. And this was before the first Earth Day. Pete Seeger, if you're familiar with anyone that is familiar with him, knows that he's been, you know, a civil rights advocate. But he went beyond that, and he was really one of the founders of the environmental rights movement too. And so that one of the things that he said at one of the Sloop festivals was that they're all tied together, and it's so true that all of those human rights issues are all tied together. So it's not a matter of, I mean, we can each choose the cause that we want to put our time and energy toward, but whatever it is, whatever cause we put our, we do choose to put our time toward, that's all part of a larger cause of bringing humanity to its consciousness of oneness.
Well, I know that musically, especially, you brought up Pete Seeger. I became quite familiar with him through another gentleman who was also back in the 70s and 80s, early 80s, quite an advocate for social change, Harry Chapin. And, you know, he's even got several songs about Pete Seeger in his music lexicon. But it seems like, you know, you talk about the fact that we've been doing this over and over again, and there are those who use a larger time frame of like 2,600 years, 2,600 years, and that we've been through this cycle that you're describing in a short 200-year span. We've been through this cycle five times, and each of the five times we've destroyed ourselves. Now, how we got started again, I don't know. I don't know if there were still a few remnants left on the planet or if everyone was killed and then we were reseeded. In other words, we're not originally from this planet, but that goes off into a subject we won't get into right now. But there are those who say that, yeah, we've done this over and over and over five times, and we're headed for number six. And the question that I have actually raised, you know, and this kind of goes to whether your aspect of optimism, if you will. But the question that I raise is, does man, based upon his history, just in this cycle alone, whether you want to go 2,600 years or you just want to do 200, doesn't matter to me. Does man really deserve to continue on? I mean, look at what he's done again.
Okay, so we are still here. Good thing, and a good sign. But a couple of points to what you were saying. The process and the cycle that you were referring to goes back further than 2,600 years, or it goes back to 4,000 or 5,000 years to the beginning of human history, with the indigenous peoples and the ancient spiritual traditions. And then we had the Hebrew tradition and the Hindu tradition going back 4,000 years. So that's really when it all starts. And each of those cycles that you refer to follow a pattern within each of those cycles, just as the four seasons do. So right now, in this new cycle that I'm referring to as our time, we're only in the springtime of this cycle, which means that there's going to be a summer fullness coming next, and then the fall will follow that, and the winter will follow that, and then the cycle will repeat it again. But the difference between this cycle and all the other earlier cycles, which go back to the beginning of human history, is that only now, in our time right now, has it been possible to see the world as one. I mean, we can think back again to 1969, 1968, 70, when we had the moon shots and the photographs sent back from the moon, where we literally physically could see the world as one with no boundaries, the planet as one with no boundaries on it. Only they're only man-made. They're not there, really. Planet is one, and so we have that, and we, this is the first time we've had the capability technologically and consciously to recognize that fact and to bring that reality about, to live as one, for humanity to live as one. So it's been, I mean, before this, whether you go back to the time of Christ or the time of Muhammad or any of the others, the world wasn't even fully discovered during those earlier eras, spiritual epochs. It's only now that we know the world as we will know it forever. And this is the first time that we've had the capacity, the ability to bring humanity together as one family. And that's a great challenge as well. And so we have that opportunity, that challenge, that capacity to bring humanity together as one family. And we also have an equal challenge on the other side. If we don't do that, then all the other, we'll go on to another war, to a World War III or whatever it ends up being. But we have that choice for the first time, and we have the tools. In each of those spiritual epics that I'm referring to, there have been tools provided to humanity, like the Golden Rule, the Ten Commandments, and so on, all the way through. Today, with the teachings of Baha'u'llah, we have the spiritual principles to unite humanity as one family, with teachings like the equality of women and men, the elimination of extremes of poverty and wealth, the elimination of prejudice. Those are all spiritual principles for our time that are becoming almost second nature to a lot of people now, that if they are put into practice and lived in the way that we're capable of living those spiritual principles, we will see the evolution of consciousness to recognize humanity as one. It may not be in our lifetime, in the next 50 years or whatever. It could take another century or two or three, even, because we are still right now in the spiritual springtime. And so again, just another piece to that is that each of those spiritual epics that I've been referring to normally typically lasts anywhere from 5 to 8 centuries for each of those epics. So we're only less than 200 years into this one now, which is going to last another 500 or more years, maybe 600, 700, 800 more years of this cycle that we're just beginning right now. That's just springtime. And so we've got a lot of time and it's a natural process that plays itself out. We can't speed up the four seasons. We may want spring to come a lot earlier than it does in some places. We may want summer to come a lot earlier, but it happens in its own natural pace. And that's pretty much the same way it is with our spiritual evolution. But we're here, all of us on this planet now are here as pretty much as spiritual midwives to bring about this process of renewal and rebirth that will lead to the spiritual summertime following this current spiritual springtime that we're in right now.
Did I hear you correctly that these are the teachings you're talking about of Baha'u'llah?
Yes.
The Baha'i Faith.
Yeah.
I was a member of the Baha'i Faith in the 90s for about a year and a half. It was a wonderful experience for me, and I still have a heck of a library of of books. I think one of my favorite sayings of his was, "If you accept one of the messengers of God, you accept them all. If you reject one of the messengers of God, you reject them all." And I also loved when we did go to the moon, or actually even before that, when we actually were able to orbit the Earth for the first time and we saw pictures of the Earth, it confirmed one of the other sayings that had reference to the fact that the Earth has no borders, no boundary line. You couldn't see any boundary lines, and everybody says, no, you can't cross that line, because if you come across that line, you're going to be in a different place. And so that was a rather profound revelation, if you will, that the space agency was able to share with the rest of us. Matter of fact, I just saw a shot, the latest satellite that was launched, and it's now 600,000 miles away, took a shot, a picture of the Earth and the Moon. And, of course, they had to circle them because they're kind of tiny. But it really put... As I looked at it, it really put things into more perspective, and I almost wish that I could get a poster of that shot, and I'm sure it'll be made available somewhere down the road. to remind me of just how, on one level, how insignificant we are in the vastness of the universe. Because you can actually see that little blue marble, as it's called, that's illuminated by the sun, our star, and then the moon just off to the lower left. And then there's darkness all around until you come to the next star and so on and so forth. And it's like, it's 600,000 miles away, and taking a shot like that, and it's going to continue on, and we're going to get smaller and smaller by its perspective. And at the same time, that religion in the early centuries of Christianity used to teach that we are the center of the universe, which was eventually disproven, or at least, shall we say, depending upon your point of view, wasn't necessarily true. Because I don't know, maybe the sun is where the center of the universe is, as far as we're concerned, as opposed to this planet. And then we have the other eight or seven, I don't know how many planets there are orbiting the sun anymore. They keep classifying and declassifying them over and over again. But the whole aspect of these types of philosophies that are out there, such as the Baha'i Faith, which is, from my perspective, it is with a founder who had great insight, if you will, as did most of the others as well. But this is more for our modern age, if you will.
Yeah, that's the whole point of the evolution of consciousness. Humanity has been given a message throughout each era or epoch in which it was appropriate to the time in which it came. And so the message or the revelation of Baha'u'llah is appropriate for our time. As I mentioned earlier, from the mid-1800s, the world was just beginning to be completely explored and discovered, and realizing that it's a huge place, but we're all sharing the same planet. And so at that point, we needed spiritual principles that related to that understanding, and that's what we have in the teachings of Baha'u'llah. As you said, a number, you quoted one, and there are a number of really especially pertinent statements relevant to today, to our time. I mean, like, another one from Baha'u'llah is, close your eyes to racial differences and welcome all with the light of oneness. Another one I think you referred to is, the earth is one country and mankind its citizens. Mm. That's the whole idea of what we did, what we were able to see only when the space shots occurred in the late 60s, early 70s. We saw the actual photographs that confirmed that. So that's another principle for today, is the harmony of science and religion. We're realizing now, and more and more, especially quantum physicists are realizing how there has to be that harmony and unity between science and religion. And that's confirmed in both of those systems of knowledge. I mean, that's what they are. Ultimately, science and religion are both systems of knowledge. One kind of science discovers knowledge through experimental means, and religion reveals knowledge through the revelations of especially the founders of the world's religions. And because reality is one, because the universe was created by one creator who has been carrying out everything that was created based on the same universal law, that means that reality is one. And if reality is one, then science and religion have to agree ultimately. And that's what more and more people are recognizing too. Scientists and philosophers and social scientists as well are recognizing that spiritual principle of our time.
But we still have a lot of people on the planet today who are hardliners, who are going to completely disagree with you, and they don't want to do this. I mean, I'm hearing programmers who are on the radio in particular, but also on television, who basically want to go back to the 1950s in terms of the ethics, the morals, the values, the family, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm thinking, you really want to go back there? Because if you go back to the 50s, you have to take it all. Everything that was going on then, you got to take it all, which means we're in the height of the Cold War, post-World War II. Mm-hmm. We're heading for Vietnam and another conflict, et cetera, et cetera.
The civil rights movement.
And the civil, it's like, can we not move? I remember, you know, you mentioned the civil rights movement. I remember when Barack Obama was first elected. And every reporter on the news was saying, yes, and of course, Barack Obama is our first black president. And I remember a gentleman in the context of all of that saying that, you know, as long as we keep referring to him as our first black president, it shows that we haven't come very far at all, because we're still referring to him as our first black president. You know, and of course, the same thing I think could be said when our first woman president is elected. It's like we're people and we're trying to find a way to live cohesively with one another. When we come back, I've got a question for you, and I want you to define something for me. And we're going to do that. Robert Atkinson is my guest, and we're talking about, I have to say, this is fascinating stuff. I'm just we're talking about the story of our times. He's also written several other books, including Mystic Journeys. We'll talk about that as well here on Tell Me Your Story. New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, and please, please, please stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
I'm Richard Dugan, back here with Robert Atkinson of Story of Our Time, as well as other works that he has put out. You can also go to robertatkinson.com, and we will be linked to his website. The interview, of course, will be on our radio show's page. It'll be on SoundCloud, iTunes. You'll actually even be able to access it via the Facebook page that we have, which is Richard Dugan, TMYS. Facebook, that's the Facebook page, Richard Dugan, TMYS. What does that stand for? Tell me your story. Robert, thank you so much for staying with us here on the program. I have a question for you in regards to consciousness.
Okay.
What is it? and give me that answer in 30 seconds or less. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, boy, 30 seconds. Well, it's a potential that we're given when we're created, that we spend our entire lives trying to fulfill that potential. But it's about, it's really about how we see, has to do with how we see the world and individuals and relationships. And so it's about a way of seeing the world and our relationship in it. We can, one of the things that I mean, this is, you know, there's no short answer to that question, but one of the things that I do in the book is I offer a continuum. It's called a consciousness continuum.
Mm-hmm.
And so to really understand what consciousness is, I think we need to look at it as a continuum, because we can, and when we do that, we can see that depending on which direction we go or where we start out will depend on where we end up. And so we can start out with what I call a pragmatic-centered perspective, which means that we start out with we recognize and we accept a sense of duality in all things. And that when we do that, when we start out with that, that's going to lead to separation, difference, generalizations, stereotypes, and bias, and prejudice, and ultimately oppression and racism, which, as we know, all lead to war as the end of that side of the continuum. But if we start out with a principle-centered perspective, which is more of a an inner state supported by a spiritual or moral attitude, then we start out with a sense of wholeness, and we can see things as a whole rather than getting lost in the parts or the pieces of the whole. So starting out with that sense of wholeness, that's going to lead us to a value of multiculturalism, to a reverence for all life, to compassion, to harmony, to ecological stewardship, to cooperation, and ultimately to universal human rights and unity, global justice. And that, as we can tell, is what will lead us to peace. So that's the two sides of the consciousness continuum. And we can choose to live according to either one of those starting points. And it's important to know which one we are living by and which one we want to live our lives by, because it's a choice. It really is a conscious choice which way we live our lives and which side of the consciousness continuum we go down. And if we're aware of that, we know that when we live with a consciousness of duality, that's going to ultimately eventually lead to racism and war and oppression and all those things. But if we consciously choose to live with a sense of wholeness or oneness, that's going to lead us down the path toward peace.
You know, it's really, on the one hand, sort of unfortunate that we can't get more people on board in that regard, because the philosophy over, as I have observed, and this is just, you know, my musings, as it were, that there's no money in peace. I mean, that's what we hear. There's no money in it. Well, you know, where's the profit? And that's right. That's what we're all struggling with, is we're all trying to just survive. We're all trying to just get by from day to day, earning that paycheck and putting food on the table, gas in the car, keeping the roof over our heads, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe we have a little extra for a vacation from time to time. It took me 10 years. After I moved to Santa Barbara, it took us 10 years to take a vacation. I mean, a real vacation, not just taking off for the day and driving up the coast. Get away from work for a week and not have to do anything other than relax and enjoy, you know, enjoy what's going on. And I think that's one of the issues that I think we have with our society, our culture here now, is just that, is that we are not, we're not really, I mean, you know, there's even criticism that we look to Europe too much to find ways of doing things. But we're Americans, and we'll figure it out. We'll do it our own way, you know, kind of thing. And we're killing ourselves. I mean, you know, we think that we're really living, but we're living to die. I mean, granted, when, you know, you come into this world, we're all going to die, right? But we seem to have found a way to, you know, facilitate that process a little faster. And corporations are assisting us in that process, or maybe they have created the programming that says it's okay for us to do these things to ourselves because, hey, you know, nobody gets out of this world alive, as my father used to say. But there are other people around the world who are thriving. They're enjoying their lives. I'm not saying they don't struggle, and there isn't a certain element of that and challenge in their lives. But at least the happiness factor. You remember there was a country, I can't remember which one, in Indonesia, in that area, that they had, instead of a GDP like we have in this country as far as the dollar, they had a happiness quotient. You know, it wasn't about the money. and the things. It was about being happy. What about that factor? How does that factor into this whole scenario? I mean, yes, you say we're in the springtime. And by the way, that prompted my thought of the Arab Spring, which lasted for a little while, and then it almost looks as though it went right back to the way it was before the springtime. But at least there was a flare-up and that type of thing. And yeah, okay, we still have summer, fall, and winter to go. But talk a little bit about these things.
Well, yeah, again, it's all part of the process, and it's all it all depends on how we view things. Another quote that I think brings this all into perspective is from the Buddha, who said, "All things originate from one essence, develop according to one law, and are destined to one aim." But we see multiple aims or different aims, and because we're all a part of this evolutionary process, we are being guided back toward our consciousness of oneness that we're really all born with. It's only when we come into this world of duality or this realm of dualities that our consciousness shifts. But when we look at reality as a continuum, it seems to change, but it's really changeless. When we talk about reality with a capital R, it's all changeless. So as what happens is that as we change, we see the same reality differently. And it's all about our perspective on it. Reality is a unified whole that comprises the entirety of creation. So we discover the reality of reality gradually. And it's, once we live our lives, most of our lives, experiencing duality. When we've done that long enough, or there comes a point in a lot of our lives when we feel like we've lived that with that consciousness of duality long enough, then we begin to seek a more principle-centered, value-based side of the reality continuum, which is the side that leads to unity and oneness. And that's the only way that we will realize our inherent connectedness as one species. And that's really what all the world's religions, religious traditions have been saying all along. And they all have the goal of transcending duality and achieving oneness. So we can think of things like yoga, sadhana, tawhid. They're all different forms of practices that lead us toward achieving oneness. And when we move along that path, along that continuum, we also recognize that there are spiritual forces guiding us toward, it's kind of like the old idea and phrase of going with the flow. Once we start moving in that direction, we can more readily see and recognize the spiritual forces that are guiding us toward oneness and that are coming into sharper focus now with everything that's happening. And what we're also being led to at the same time was what Brother Wayne Teasdale called, this unity is the heart of all mysticisms. It is awareness of non-duality and non-separation, of no distance between ourselves, the ultimate mystery, and all other beings. So as we move along that side of the continuum, we come to know that our life is connected to all things, and that means that we have no need to any longer try to create opposition, to conquer, or to destroy. All those things become needless, useless, as we move closer and further along that that side of the continuum toward oneness.
So this moving forward towards unity and oneness, is this something that is that can be or is a natural occurrence, or is this something that actually does have to be worked at by humanity?
Yeah, it's both at the same time.
okay.
it can't be any other way, really. I mean, it's not going to happen naturally as the four seasons seem to happen naturally. But, you know, every year it just happens the same every year as four seasons happen. Humanity is different from the world of nature in that we have a different level of consciousness and a different potential of our consciousness. The spiritual springtime that I referred to that we're in right now will only evolve toward a spiritual summertime to come with our help, as I also referred to before. We're the spiritual midwives in this process, and so without us, it could take. Who knows if it would happen on its own, if humanity didn't do anything to help the process along. I think we really do need to think of ourselves as spiritual midwives to help bring about this this collective transformative rebirth that is really already started, and it's too late to reverse the process right now. So the only thing that we can or should be thinking about is helping it along rather than preventing it from happening. You know, you can't stop the baby from being born once its time is ready. It's there.
Well, and the other thing too is that good analogy. We are pregnant, and we are going to give birth. And you're either pregnant or you're not. There's no in between, and it's coming.
Right.
I would say that we are in the early stages of the first trimester.
That's right. But which equates to the springtime.
Exactly. And it's interesting too that Barbara Marx Hubbard, who we've had on this program a number of times, when I first interviewed her back in 2007 and 8. She talked about this process this evolutionary process we're going to, and she used that analogy of giving birth, and that the nature of birthing a child by a human is a painful process. I have no points of reference. I know my mother does, my sisters do, but it is a painful process. But in the end, once the baby is birthed, there's the calm. There's the peace, and, you know, we can then use the analogies as well. There's the unity. There's the oneness, if you will. Now mother and baby and father. Family now, one unit, if you will. Well, that's what you're describing here and what's been described down through the centuries in the ancient wisdom teachings, that these are just, if you will, we could chalk it up to, this is a cycle of life, folks. It's just the cycle of life.
Yeah, and it happens on both the individual and the collective level in the same way.
Yeah. And you can't fight it. You really can't. I mean, it's coming. And the sooner we get on the bandwagon, so to speak, and begin the process of accepting that reality, the better off we're going to be. And I think that acceptance of it is a huge step, is it not, to not only dealing with it, but, you know, being able to mentally and psychologically cope within ourselves with what's happening.
Right. Yeah, that's huge for sure. Understanding and accepting the process is a key to the whole thing happening. And again, happening smoothly. So, yeah, we all... You know, and this is happening, I think, with events like the Women's March and others that we've seen recently, the youth marches as well. Those are all examples of how more people are recognizing the process and wanting choosing to become part of the process, and pretty much basically using the idea of love as a spiritual activism of our time, using that as their approach.
Well, it's you used an interesting phrase there, becoming part of the process. We advocate that rather than trying to control the process, because it doesn't work. I mean, you know, to attempt to control the process of the natural world, if you will, and what you're discussing is just that, it really is the natural world, is quite futile. And, or to use a Star Trek analogy, it's futile.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because it's coming. And the sooner we embrace the reality that it is coming, the sooner we are going to be able to basically unstress ourselves. I mean, that's the biggest detriment in our society right now is stress. I had some blood work done just recently, and I had what was it? Oh, it was my glucose levels were rather high. I mean, rather high. All the other numbers in my blood work were fine, you know, in the middle to high normal range. So no concerns there. But the glucose spiked up a bit this time. Now, the previous times it was just a little above the high normal, not nothing dangerous. So I started doing some research, and it started to describe the reasons why that could be. And it went through a lot of course, physiological reasons. And then it came across stress. Stress can cause your glucose levels to spike? I didn't know that. And then I started thinking about my life and the things that I'm dealing with in my life and the things I concern myself with. And I realized, you know, bottom line, you need to get a grip, pal. You need to get a grip. And so I've actually been doing that in this fashion. For example, with our president, I've not been a fan from the day he chose to run. He announced his running. I said, I don't want him as president because he's a bully. I don't want a bully as a president. And I let it go. And it wasn't until September 2017 that I got sucked in to the whole thing that just caused me more undue strife internally. It took me 6 months to get unsucked. And I finally was able to say, thank you, teacher, him, for teaching me how I don't want to behave. And now I can actually put a greater spin on that. And it's not a spin that is false in any way. It's from what you have described, Robert, it's, hey, this is the natural course of things. No different than the sun rising and the sun setting each day. So let it go.
Right.
Let it go.
You can choose to swim upstream or with the flow. The choice is everyone's. And we really are in the process of, not only with the recent events like that I mentioned, like the Women's March and the Youth March and all the others, we really are witnessing a global movement of building a culture of oneness. And it's happening in so many different ways right now. Many more people like women and youth are leading the process of building a culture of oneness for us right now, today. And so many more, as we go on from here, you know, they're going to be more and more becoming part of that process of building a culture of oneness.
Yeah. Well, it's a powerful thing that we're trying to build through this program as well, and that's the same thing, and realizing that we're all connected. We're all interconnected. We're interdependent on one another. And the actions of one affect the actions of all. And we're beginning to see that more and more on a global level, especially with the pollution in the oceans. I'm seeing more and more documentaries about the plastics that are washing up on beaches that used to be pristine on islands that were uninhabited. We're beginning to see the effects of the Yokoshima nuclear power plant after the tsunami. We're starting to see deformities in the sea life on the west coast of the United States. And the list goes on, and we're having an impact on one another, and people are making changes. They're making shifts from a physical level. But now I think from what you're describing, especially through your book, The Story of Our Time, we now may need to make another shift emotionally and spiritually.
Yep.
Do you have any suggestions beyond what we've already talked about for helping us in addition to, and please give me that quote again, that pledge that you talked about. I've got it on the screen, but I like to have the guests talk about it. But anything else beyond that pledge that we can use as a mantra or a way to help us individually to make that shift and then help others as well?
Yeah, it's really about, first of all, really understanding what a culture of oneness really means. And in the book, I explain that for me, a culture of oneness means living in unity within our multiplicity, within our diversity, and honoring our diversity within our common heritage as human beings, and safeguarding our differences while recognizing we are more alike than unlike. So that's really what the goal is, what we're evolving toward, is building a culture where we will all, regardless of our differences, be able to live in unity, and we will honor each other's differences and diversity as human beings, and we will safeguard those differences. So the pledge that I have on my website is, in all my thoughts and actions, I pledge to look upon all things with the eye of oneness. And when we do that, if we do that on a regular basis, daily or any kind of a regular basis, as we would any other kind of a mantra, we'll begin to recognize differences in the way we perceive things around us and others around us. And as we interact with others around us, we'll begin to perceive differences the more and more we take on and keep that as a regular practice. So it's just like, I mean, you can think of this pledged as a something like the practice of yoga or any other spiritual practice. The more you do it, the more you'll come to realize what you're been trying to visualize or to say over and over. Mm. So it's really that's using that as a regular mantra helps establish a habit of thinking, speaking, and acting with a consciousness of oneness, which will create a pattern that will then enable us to live in oneness. And that's the goal. So the more we think it and practice it, the more we will actually live it.
Before I let you go, I want to make sure we let our listeners know, first of all, that you are listening to Tell Me Your Story with Robert Atkinson, author of The Story of Our Time. You have a special event that's coming to Santa Barbara in June. Tell us about it.
Well, it's the Evolutionary Leaders Circle has a retreat each year, and this year they've chosen Santa Barbara. So it's a group of, it's growing every year. Just recently this year, they've added maybe 20 more members to that circle. So it gets larger every year. And you mentioned Barbara Marks Hubbard. I'm pretty sure she'll be coming to that retreat along with so many others. But if anyone is interested in learning more about evolutionary leaders, you can go to evolutionaryleaders.net. There's a lot on the website there about that. But the idea of the retreat is that all of these members of this circle come together, interact, and spend four or five days with each other and really just developing a network and a plan and plans for helping to bring about the conscious evolution of humanity. And so it's a huge task and challenge, but as each of the evolutionary leaders go out and interact with others, that whole concept kind of just expands like as throwing a pebble into a lake would, the circles would expand that way. So that's what the retreat is. That's what the retreat is all about in June in Santa Barbara.
And that's June 20th through the 24th. And we also hope, Robert, that we get a chance to grab you even for a little bit to continue this conversation in person. I think that it would be wonderful to not only meet you in person, but also talk more about these ideas and other writings, including the Mystic Journey. I haven't had a chance to get into that, but we'll have to save that for another time. And I really appreciate the time that you've given us here today to share your story as well as this whole aspect of the story of our time.
Thank you, Richard. It's been a pleasure.
I also have three final questions for you before we let you go. Again, thank you. The first question is, who is Robert Atkinson?
You want me to answer that? Is that a question you're asking?
That is the question. That's the first of three.
I'm an evolutionary being put on this beautiful planet to achieve the potential that I was given by my creator.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
To expand the awareness that we are all one human family so that we can all begin to live as one human family on this planet.
And what is your life's purpose?
Pretty much to do what I just mentioned, to try to get my understanding and awareness out there to others so that that will help others realize that we are all members of the same human family.
Robert Atkinson's been my guest, the author of the latest, the work we're talking about, The Story of Our Time. We look forward to having you back again in the near future as well. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.